Group meeting Sunday, 17th July 1977.
Might be quite useful to start at the very heart of things where our group meetings are concerned. We say that our concern is the living of the religious life. And the living of the religious life is not confined to a study of the religions in the usual sense of the word study. Because that can be intellectual pastime combined with a certain degree of social pleasure. The living of the religious life. And why are we concerned with the living of the religious life? Ordinarily, all over the world, there are vast numbers of people who believe that as a result of living what they call or what they see as a religious life, there will be a good result here and now for themselves, and a supremely happy result in a hereafter. It has to be heaven for the Christian, it has to be nirvana for the Buddhist, it has to be moksha for the Hindu, it has to be garodimana for the Zarathustrian, and so on. All right. That is the usual conception. But we are trying to understand the reality of religion and the religious life. And you've often heard me say that the context of religion, in the profoundest sense, is transcendence itself. A restoration of our own being into completely harmonious relationship with the one total reality, which is the whole universe, the manifested and the unmanifested, the known and the unknown, the so-called, if ephemeral, transient, and mortal, and the immutable, the permanent, the immeasurable, and so forth, into complete relationship with that. We have also tried to see through these years that the living of the religious life is a life of discipline. Discipline not in the sense of conforming to laid down techniques of development, as we call them, but living in such a manner that there is a perpetual discovering of what is truth, what is reality. A discovering not merely by the brain, but a discovering which is a realizing in our innermost consciousness of the actual nature of things immediately in the here now, from moment to moment. Otherwise, truth becomes a piece of truth, a dead fossil, a concept or a set of concepts and verbal formulations. We are alive. Not only are we alive, the entire universe is alive. And it undergoes constant change. But in what manner does it undergo that change? In very general terms, there is the evolution of cosmos out of chaos in terms of the manifested universe. Each of us is a microcosm. And this microcosm has to be a cosmos and not an organism in a state of conflict. We experience conflict because we have the power to look within ourselves and discover that we can say nay to the universal process. We can defy God and nature, or the unborn, the unbecome, unmade, call the transcendent, whatever you like, any name you like, and the natural process for mankind. We can defy that and struggle against it, attempting to assert ourselves and our desire and our will as against the universal process. We have this power. We have the power of self-recognition, and we know that we have a will of our own. Nature ordinarily has no will of its own at all. It just manifests the functioning of what we understand as the laws of nature. There is no question of a tree saying nay to anything. If a seed has fallen just by a great big wall and it sprouts, it can't tell the wall, get out of my way. It just can't. It adjusts itself to the existence of that wall. But it does not say yea to the wall and adjust itself so much that it will grow completely away from the wall. The natural laws operate, and in the growth of that tree, that wall may get hurt, may get destroyed even, you see. So the whole of nature is just a balancing of the forces at play without any one particular aspect saying yea or nay to it. But we have the power to look within. A tree can't look within and say, I am this particular oak tree named John Smith, you see, or this particular rose bush, what's it, hybrid tea so and so, you see. The trees and the animals and so forth can't do that. It's only man, as far as we know, on this planet, who can do that. So we have the power to assert a self-will as against the not-self. Therefore, there is conflict. So when we say there has to be discipline, which means fundamentally the process of learning all the time, discipulus, the Latin, means a learner. It is our act of learning which makes whatsoever we learn from the teacher. If anything is given to us to which we must conform, again there is conflict. Because something in us will agree, perhaps in part, with what is laid down. And another aspect of us will say, oh no, I don't agree with that at all. So there is the state of conflict perpetuated. As long as that state of conflict is perpetuated, because our own self-consciousness and self-will is against the natural process, is against what is intended man should become, because of that conflict, we are all the time confined to the ambivalent sphere, the dualistic sphere. Yes, no, good, evil, pleasure, pain, cruelty, kindness, love, hate, and so on and so on. And we are caught in this struggle within ourselves. We never escape the confines of the unawakened animalish side of us, which has descended into sub-humanity, not full humanity. So, the dormant intelligence within us, the profoundest aspects of intelligence within us, never come to full fruition. We see as through a glass darkly. We don't see truth. Truth for us, which means all, one of the meanings of truth for us is that it is that which enables us to come to our full fruition, to understand completely the dualistic manifestation of our whole environment, integrate the duals through our own self-purification and release that transcendent awareness in the innermost depths of our consciousness, which sees the complete wholeness of everything. And in that, man realizes holiness. Where nature is concerned, when, say, a tree blossoms out, and in its perfect blossoming, it realizes its wholeness, its holiness. Now that is one way of looking at it. There is a profounder way of looking at it. It is not that each particular aspect of the manifested world realizes anything in the sense that I alone did it, so to say. It is the totality which comes to fulfillment through the particular individual manifestation. And this is the marvel of all existence. This is one of the reasons, one of the deeper reasons why the religions of the world, the theistic religions put it in the easiest way to understand it. They say that God is omnipresent. If God is omnipresent, omniscient, omnipotent, then what is it, who is it that comes to fruition but the omnipresent, the omniscient, the omnipotent, of which you and I are integral part and parcel? It's very important to see this. When we see this, not merely intellectually, not just with the brain, but we see it so intensely, so completely, with our total psychophysical being, including all our senses, our whole body and our whole psyche, then it has become something which is just second nature to us. And that becomes our permanent background, our ground roots, our source from which we function. And then conflict assumes a totally different aspect. There will be the pairs of opposites functioning through our own organism also, but no longer in terms of a self-isolated self-consciousness deliberately imposing its will upon the not-self, the environment. See now, this is a tremendous difference. In this sense, conflict has ceased. One is at peace within. This is an extraordinary thing. Because do remember, pleasure and pain will unquestionably come right through our lives. It must do so. Otherwise, we can't live normally. The pleasure-pain mechanism of the body is something which is the real safeguard for the continuance of its existence and for producing that situation where the possibility and the opportunity for transcendence to come to full realization of itself in terms of the word man and what man signifies can take place. So the person must continue to exist for that reason. Not because I want to live 100 years or whatever it is. That's all nonsensical. Or that I have a great work or a small work to do in this world and so forth. Don't forget that the universe was able to dispense with each one of us until we were born. And it's gone on, how much, about 17,000 million years? A short time, true, but something which is significant and can teach us something. And after our charming little flash in the pan for 70, 80, 90, 100, 110 years, and we get medals and visits from Majesty and so forth to commemorate the 110th year and whatnot. After that, the universe continues the next 17,000 million years, absolutely unconcerned whether we existed or not. I mean, really see that and feel that. And one is utterly free from any sort of false self-esteem. There is a right self-esteem. This organism could fulfill the purposes of transcendence, become the living vehicle through which transcendence manifests its human full. Just as transcendence manifests its rosehood or its oakhood or its tigerhood through the perfect manifestation of a rose bush or an oak tree or a tiger. Now you see, when one becomes aware of existence in this mode, this kind of mode, one is conscious of life in this manner, then one is certainly in harmony with the world. Now do remember, harmony does not mean just a succession of concords. When discords and concords emerge in the living process in the right way and get rightly related to each other by us who are self-responsible for doing that, then the overriding truth is that life is a harmony. Not merely the pleasant, not merely the unpleasant, but such a process of living that the difficulties and the sorrows and the pains of life become rightly related as life moves on from moment to moment and assume manifestations which are concordant, then they again move into discordant positions. You can't have, and it's, one just becomes a cabbage if one tries to do it, permanent concord all along the line. One would be utterly bored, die of boredom if you had constant concord. It would be a static condition, we'd be fossils. You see? No, it's not like that. Just as in Western music, and this is where Western music teaches wonderful lessons, the parts of music enter into positions of discord are resolved by the creative musician into positions of concord, again move out into positions of discord and so forth. And all sorts of wonderful things can be made with the parts of music. Counterpoint and canon and fugue, and you can produce symphonies and sonatas and goodness knows what not. Wonderful operas and song and all the rest of it. Okay. Life is like that. You see, the music moves. It's never static. If you play just one note all the time, especially if you're blowing a horn or your own trumpet, what happens? Your neighbor comes and he wouldn't be unjustified in perhaps banging you on the head for it. So you see, one has to approach life like that. Now, what sort of conflict then, or rather, what happens to the whole question of conflict in our life? There is no conflict in the unintelligent sense of it. There is trial. One is tried. One's psycho-spiritual muscles are stretched, and one has to be at it in the right way. But this very conflict, that is to say, the interplay of duels, in those situations where they are in disagreement, is the stimulus which makes us see deeper and deeper and makes us more skilled in producing counterparts of concord, or concordant positions. Therefore, this conflict is not destructive of human welfare in the true sense. We talk about the ill state, in Buddhist terms, dukkha. Dukkha. And I've said so often, the deep meaning of dukkha, far from the infinite. The divine harmony made bad. Now, the divine harmony is not a continuous concord. It is this right movement and relationship of concord and discord. Then what is the meaning of the divine harmony being made bad, spoiled? We have again a wonderful practical manifestation. Take an orchestra. You have discords, but they are all playing the correct note, the right note. If somebody insisted upon coughing all the time whilst he is playing, or sneezing, or making a row or a disturbance, that is not a note which is in line with the harmony of the whole orchestra. It is out of tune, out of rhythm, and so forth, is it not? Now you see, these are ways in which we can sort of see into the depths and understand both concord and discord. The right kind of discord, the right kind of concord. When we really see that, we are saved from an immense amount of trouble and misery and frustration above all. Because when we know that life, we are able to see life in the right way and are moving in rhythm with it, then we cease to grasp at this, that, or the other. When we grasp at any one thing, we stop its further development as well as our own. We ourselves are our own jailers, warders, as well as prisoners. We are both combined in one. If I grasp something, that something also grasps me. Isn't that so? That is an actuality. Now, you can see how karma functions. This word karma is very important. You know, Socrates, when he asked that question, which he always asked, what is justice? He was really talking of karma in the depths. What is justice? You see? What is this thing, karma? How does it operate? We think in somewhat rigid terms. Our minds, our mode of consciousness, or that is to say, our awareness of the life process as it moves on from moment to moment, is so sluggish, it's so limited, so befogged, that we cannot see that the karmic process is a process which functions in the immediate now, from split second to split second. All this change that takes place in nature by itself, how does it take place? At any one moment, the state of the universe is the complete resultant of the sum total of forces in the previous split second. See, this is one of the great lessons from nature we never learn, we never see. Now, nature cannot grasp something and work against time. We can, by grasping. This is the element that we introduce into the life of living creatures, ourselves and animals and so forth. We introduce this by grasping any one thing and stopping it from undergoing its proper change, its proper change. If we don't grasp it, but are completely in right relationship with it, then both of us change in the right way, simultaneously. And the harmony of life, the rhythm of life, is not upset, not obstructed, not made bad. The ill state, dukkha. See, these things are not easy to see, admittedly. But this is precisely our self-discipline, our task of learning, learning from instant to instant. What we learn is not something which we preserve afterwards. Oh, I've learnt my lesson, and now I know. Not a bit of it. I am learning my lesson continuously, non-stop. That is the reality. That is the actual fact. See? But by grasping, by the intellect particularly being the slave of desire, which is never questioned, which is never looked into, just this vague, blind drive within us, which we inherit through natural evolution, the intellect being the slave of that, intelligence in the profound sense never comes to fruition. This is one of the saddest elements in human life. Such is the state of affairs in the world, that people just don't know the true meaning of intelligence. Consider, for example, all the intelligence tests that the so-called intelligence and the intelligence quotients, which are made up and all the rest of it, and associated with examinations and whatnot and whatnot. What are these intelligence tests like? They are merely tests to discover how good a computer my brain is, or how good, what specific powers of retention my brain as a sponge possesses. The question asked in the examination is the little squeeze on the sponge, and out comes a little bit of stuff. And very often it is not only stuff but plenty of nonsense, as I know from my experience correcting papers. It's like that. Then what is this thing, intelligence? They said you can measure intelligence. Intelligence is the immeasurable. What you can measure is the memory box or the efficiency of this computer, the brain. But the brain is merely the concretest expression of mind, and its function is to be purely an instrument of observation. An instrument of observation in this sense, that it is the place where all the different impressions that come to us from outside, or all the different memories that rise up from within, are registered and they are categorized and put in their proper shelves and pigeonholes and whatnot and whatnot. And what is tested is the ability of this very, very efficient secretary called John Smith to go to the right pigeonhole and pull out the right file. And if he can't go to the right pigeonhole and pull out the right file, well, he gets a lower salary, or he ought to, but still, there we are. It's like that, is it not? That is not intelligence. That is just a mechanical activity, which is a necessary activity. Just as the pleasure-pain reaction of the body is a necessary process in order to preserve our existence here. Intelligence is the power of the mind in itself. Brain and psyche are our own individual stuff. The brain is the physical stuff, the psyche is the non-physical stuff, so to say. Funny to say it's non-physical stuff, but there we are. Mind is something universal. It is nondescript. Mind is not a container. Mind is not a mechanical synthesizer like the brain is. The brain is a mechanical synthesizer of the different impressions that come to oneself as a living organism. And this mechanical synthesizing has as its principal instrument for mechanical performance, language. This is where language comes in. Speech is the most remarkable faculty which the psychophysical organism as such has. Now, the psyche, I say, is our own something. Something like this happens. The body is made up of matter, as we say. But this matter, which has this particular pattern, it's a unique pattern, everyone's body is different from everybody else's body, even though everybody changes, But howsoever they change, each body remains a unique body, different from everybody else's. The matter composing this body, where does it come from? The one universal matter. I should say, the one universal energy matter. Because the interconvertibility of matter and energy is now and at last a scientifically established fact. In the past, it wasn't a scientifically established fact. There was always this extraordinary difficulty, this gulf between what is material and what is immaterial. But now we know that matter is just the concretized manifestation of pure energy. And our senses, as they function ordinarily as senses, are quite unable to see that matter and energy are not two different things but are interconvertible. And science has enabled us to establish that as a fact. In the past, ages ago, in India certainly, when they propounded the teaching which is embodied in the word Brahman, all separation, all distinctions were out, completely out. It was the absolute all. You see? Now, this is, we'll just use the word matter in the Kamala Garden sense for convenience. Now, this comes out of universal matter. This energy, which we call mind, which is immeasurable. It's not like electricity or heat, which you can measure in calories, or light and all these different energies which are measurable and controllable by us. It is an energy which lies outside our possibility, so far anyway, to measure, control, etc. It is a universal energy. It is the creative energy of the universe. That aspect of transcendence which brings into being manifestation in various grades from the subtlest, which we call consciousness, right down to ordinary material objects, which we call matter. This energy interacting with energy in its other forms, which brought the physical body into being, utilizes the structure of the brain, the ductless glands, the bloodstream, and so forth, in order to bring about the manifestations of thought and feeling and so on, which we call mental processes. We have no mind of our own. There is no such thing as having a mind of your own. Mind is the universal thing. Mind you, I admit quite freely that this is my own presentation. This is how I present it, for the simple reason that I have found it to be the most convenient way of trying to make use of that which is very deep and difficult, you see. But it makes the situation easier to understand. Otherwise, if we use mind and say my mind, and we also use the word psyche, well, what is psyche, what is mind, what is brain? But if you look at it this way, it is easier to see the thing in its wholeness. And it is, I believe, I have to believe it because I propounded it myself, less misleading than so many other forms in which these things are presented. Now, language is the instrument, symbolical sound. Symbolical sound is the instrument by which the brain synthesizes, mechanically synthesizes, all the impressions it receives. When the brain is quiet and still, which it never is until one has disciplined oneself, learned the nature of reality, and utilizing our ability to pay attention in the right way, enabled the brain to be such that it can go silent and still by itself, and yet we remain fully awake, then mind in its totality is not obstructed by the organism. This is the great thing. This is the condition, the state, this is the rationale through which enlightenment takes place, through which there is complete fulfillment, through which there is complete freedom. The impress of universal mind, because it is shapeless, formless, immeasurable, nondescript, upon the organism, if the brain is quiet, if one's whole being has been purified, the psychophysical being has been purified and rightly trained, then allows concepts to emerge later on, and those concepts are formulated in words of the particular language you use as vessels, so to say, to contain the influence, not the substance, because it has no substance, to contain the influence of that transcendent impress by this realized transcendence through you, or if you like, use the commoner garden, your realization of transcendence, and then you write or speak accordingly. That is prophetic speech, and that is scriptural writing. You see the difficulties involved. Now, this self-discipline, let's come back to this, self-discipline. Consider it like this. It's a learning of the one and only self, which is the totality, by the individual self, which is a fragment of that totality. It is a learning of or about the one total reality of the macrocosm by the microcosm, yourself. A dog or a cat, an elephant or anything like that cannot do this. Only you and I can do this. This lies at the heart of the nature of self-discipline. You know that marvelous phrase, it goes right back to the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious document of the whole of the Indo-European race. Right back in the Rig Veda is that statement, Atmanam Atmana Pasya. Pasya, to see. Atmanam, the accusative case, to see the Atma, the supreme reality, the ultimate reality, Atmana, by means of the self, which is the microcosmic self. So many people, of course, when they just read the statement, they don't appreciate this subtle point that the macrocosm is seen by the microcosm. When I say macrocosm and microcosm, you immediately awake to the difference, apparent difference between the totality and the limited person. the particular finite mortal thing is that which comes into being, progresses, dies, as we say in ordinary parlance. You see? That is the microcosm. The macrocosm doesn't change. How can infinity become more or less? Can you add or subtract anything from infinity? Can you multiply or divide infinity? You see, you can't. Now, as and when this, the microcosm, has truly seen, then any conflict in the ill sense, the being far from the infinite, has completely disappeared. Language also stops. There are no words for it. All of you, all of us, sometime or other, well, I hope we have all had, all of us have had that wonderful felicity, have suddenly sort of loved someone or something in this transcendental sense. Non-grasping. This sense of wonder, this sense of marvel, not a mere attraction, not as wanting to possess, wanting to enjoy anything, but this thing, this transcendental love, which is a sudden awakening of the microcosm to its absolute indissolubility with the macrocosm. And that is love, if you like. We have had that kind of experience. And it is that sort of thing that happens. Therefore, there is no grasping in it at all. What is it to grasp? There is, why is there nothing to grasp? Because there is no otherness where the macrocosm is concerned. Where is the otherness of it? That is why, again, we have that phrase, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. You know that I rather jib at that translation. I would prefer to translate it the other way around, Brahman is me. Just alter the case, you see. Instead of having this in the nominative and that in the accusative, transfer them, you see, and say, Brahman is me, Brahman is I. See, it's like that. Now, let's go back to this Atmanam Atmana Pasya, to see the Atma by means of the Atma. What is the meaning of to see? Looking with your eyes, seeing with your brain as a thought, a concept, not at all. That is useless because when the winds of fate become a hurricane of fate, the dear old macrocosm will disappear out of your consciousness double quick and you'll pick up your skirts and run for your life. Won't you? What is the meaning of to see Pasya in that sense? Associate the meaning of the word see with the real meaning of the word vidya, knowledge. It is translated as knowledge. And the root of vidya is vid, which means to see. Video, the Latin video, videre, I see. And that, they say, is knowledge. You could, if you like, use the word wisdom. But in our minds, which are fragmented minds, not whole minds, the moment we use the word knowledge, or the moment we use the word wisdom or see, we immediately sort of dissociate it from us as some separate thing. No. There is no separate thing which is seeing or understanding or knowledge or wisdom. Your entire consciousness, in the deepest seat of your consciousness, there has been a complete turning about. A turning about which has utterly freed itself from all the limitations of isolativeness, of separativeness in consciousness. You are no longer conscious in terms of I am I and not you or this or that or the other. You are conscious in terms of totality, as a matter of course. You don't have to seek it, you don't question it. Of course it is so, that is the fact, that's all. Supposing somebody were to tell me, Feroz, that is not your thumb which you're holding up. I'd think he's crackers. Of course it is me. You see how the brain works? Of course it is me. Of course it is my thumb. In that way, there is this sense of courseness which expresses the complete union of the microcosm with the macrocosm. Now, I trust we have seen and understood something at least of the matter of self-discipline, conflict, and language.